This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Tim Wise, America's foremost anti-racist activist and writer, is here to discuss with us his new book, Under the Affluence, where he brilliantly engages the roots and ramifications of radical inequality in our nation, and he'll punctuate that discussion with an examination of Donald Trump's appeal to and stoking the rise of white nationalists. Tim Wise.
Hey, how are you?
I'm a little under the political weather with the headlong march of both Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, the Republican Party as a whole. What I have in front of me is a 1989 New York Post full-page newspaper ad by Trump. His rantings did not start just opportunistically to stoke white nationalists and white supremacy for this campaign. They go way back. It's a full-page ad talking about the roving bands of wild criminals that roam our neighborhood, dispensing their own vicious brand of twisted hatred upon whomever they encounter. What he was talking about was reinstatement of the death penalty to execute minors in New York who had been accused of the Central Park rape case known as the Jaga case. Of course, we know that our brothers have been exonerated, although Donald Trump to this date continues to reprimand and accuse them and will not take back one single iota of venom that he spewed. But he actually was part of a real lynch mob to indict these youngsters. So I want to start from there and talk about your thoughts on what I think is really the rise of Trump, which has always been due to his stoking the rise of white nationalists.
I think there's no doubt that his comments then and his unwillingness to acknowledge what even the prosecuting attorney's office ultimately had to acknowledge there, which was the ultimate innocence of those young men who were accused of the crime and now exonerated by a confession on the part of the actual rapist, as well as physical evidence, says a lot about not only his insipid willingness to engage in the politics of racial scapegoating and blame and attack, but also suggests something about his character when it comes to an inability to acknowledge error. There's a lot of elements of an authoritarian personality. And certainly the racial element of his is troubling, but it's also this inability to admit error, which is a sign of narcissism. It's an authoritarian personality, someone who, confronted with evidence of his inaccuracy, simply won't acknowledge it. I mean, he did the same thing the other day when he was confronted with the tweet that he had sent out about the guy that rushed the stage and tried to disrupt his rally the other day, and he put up this tweet about him being connected to ISIS, and then it was proven that the video that supposedly proved that this guy was with ISIS was all a hoax. His response was not, sorry, I made a mistake. His response was, what do I know? It's on the internet. He's the kind of guy who will not acknowledge error. And it's incredibly dangerous for someone like that to be so incredibly close to possibly being not just a nominee of a major party, but potentially, worst comes to worst, their president of the United States. And it's something, he's been guilty of for a very long time when it comes to the racial angle. He and his father's organization have a history of being accused of and ultimately found responsible for patterns and practices of racial discrimination. He shows no indication or acknowledgement of the importance of addressing issues of racism and discrimination. Found guilty of engaging in that in his own real estate practice and his father's. And you have a long pattern whereby we can evaluate this individual and recognize that whether it's his authoritarianism in general or whether it's the racial angle of that authoritarianism, he is a pretty dangerous individual with a pattern that's pretty discernible at this point.
Whether it's Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, every single one of those candidates explicitly capitalized on and were rooted in the issues of white supremacy and xenophobia. And I'm not terribly impressed with the way that certainly the Democratic Party candidates have responded to or seemed to understand the nature of the oppression and the zest for self-determination that emanates from communities of color. Your thoughts?
the Southern strategy put in place by Nixon in 1968 really has now become, rather than just a tactical strategy by the right, it has become the official playbook of the right. And so it's been elevated from, say, fringe Hail Mary pass to try to win the election for Nixon in 68, which ultimately won, to the normative political operation of the Republican Party, and one that the Democratic Party has never really figured out a way to defeat thoroughly. Winning elections from time to time does not mean you've defeated the strategy, and it keeps coming back again and again. It's interesting to watch the right beating itself about the head every time that this kind of thing results in someone like a Donald Trump being elevated to the level that he is right now. They all act as if somehow this is inexplicable. How in the world could this man get as far as he has? My goodness, what are we, you know, the National Review doing a full issue of how did this racist and xenophobe become the head of our party, basically. Well, you know, this is coming from a magazine, the National Review, that openly advocated segregation. William F. Buckley openly said that black people weren't civilized enough to vote in the South, and that was why white people there had every right to maintain white supremacy. It's amazing that people who have stoked the flames of racism and xenophobia and all kinds of bigotry are now shocked when Frankenstein's monster actually gets up off the table and walks around and does damage in the neighborhood. It's really not all that surprising.
Your new book, Under the Affluence, for me, what you have done there is something that I still think is somewhat problematic in the white left, which is very often there's a bifurcation of the issue of race and class. You conjoin the two, and you deal with the economic inequality in the context of the melding to that, and understanding that economic inequality and the demonization of those in need are that conjoinder of race and class, and who are the poorest among us, people of color. But please tell us a little bit about what brought you to this particular book, which some describe as dealing with the heartless war against the poor and the swooning addiction to the rich that exposes the moral sickness at the heart of our culture.
Several years ago, when I conceived of the book, there was a lot of discussion, obviously, about economic inequality. Occupy, by that time, was technically over with. And so you had the Occupy movement, you had the various writers, Thomas Piketty and others, writing books about inequality, and all this discussion about, you know, the 1% versus the 99% and the wealthiest one-tenth of 1% earning the same amount of wealth as the bottom 90% of the American population. All of that conversation was happening, which I thought was great. Talking about economic inequality is very important. But what was missing from most all of that discussion was the realization that the class system in the United States has a direct connection to the history of racial apartheid and white supremacy. And the bifurcation of those issues on the left has been very dangerous. And we see it even now with the Sanders campaign. You know, Bernie Sanders talks about economic inequality often. When he talks about race, he might talk about it with regard to policing, which is good. He certainly should. He might talk about it with regard to housing disparities in inner city areas. But he doesn't really make the case explicitly, as I think he needs to, and I think as we all do, that the reason the class system is as vicious in this country as it is precisely because for years, and really going back historically hundreds of years, to the colonies, working class white folks have been led to believe if they just played by the rules, everything would be fine and they would eventually, quote-unquote, make it. The myth of meritocracy, which, you know, black and brown folks have never really had the luxury of believing, but white folks have been encouraged to believe and given just enough power to believe is true. But also working-class white folks have been afforded what W.E.B. Du Bois called the psychological wage of whiteness, which was the way of saying, you know, you might not have much, but at least you're not black. So don't rebel. Don't fight the system. You'll at least be better than those people. We've seen historically the way that that has worked to tamp down working class rebellion. It has been what Marx probably would have called the transmission belt of false consciousness for working class white people, which is to say that you can keep folks in line, you can limit class rebellion, you can get people to acquiesce to a class system by convincing them that as long as they're better off than those people over there, be they black, be they Mexican, be they indigenous, be they Asian, that somehow you may not have much, but you have this caste position that elevates you in the culture. And I think that until we begin to connect the dots between the culture of cruelty, as I refer to it in the book, that explains economic inequality and which to this day destroys the lives and the opportunities of millions of
working class white folks as well as people of color, between that and the immiseration of black and brown communities, neither those black and brown communities nor white communities are really going to be able to get free.
Help us understand the nature of the impoverishment. The impoverishment which is not by inadvertence, not by personal DNA, but is systemic. The culture of poverty, the predatory nature and influence of poverty on people of color in this society. The role of poverty, the systemic intent to impoverish people
right.
who are of color in this country.
We don't really talk about the way in which communities of color became impoverished. And the thing that Bernie Sanders the other day called the ghetto, which was a very, you know, absurd way of characterizing communities. But, you know, it's a very sort of old school way. So I guess, you know, we're sort of used to hearing that. We don't think about how the so-called ghetto became the ghetto. And I started thinking about this last year when Baltimore, when the rebellion uprising took place in Baltimore, right? There was all this sort of hemming and hawing and teeth gnashing about these out of control young black people who were throwing rocks through the CBS window. And regardless of what one thinks of the tactical brilliance or non-brilliance of that kind of activity, the reality is that unless you understand how inner city Baltimore came to look the way that it does today, and not just Baltimore, but other places, unless you understand the systemic violence done to inner city Baltimore via urban renewal, where you had in that and other cities, interstates driven through the heart of black communities, bringing bulldozers in and knocking buildings down, why is that not violence? If I throw a rock through a window in an act of rebellion, that's considered violence. If I bring in, with the backing of the government, a bulldozer and knock down your business, knock down your apartment, knock down your row house to make way for a shopping mall or a parking lot or an office building or an interstate, that's considered progress. That's not violence. That's what happened in Baltimore. That's what happened in city after city after city. Freddie Gray is a really good example of how this worked. Not only was he ultimately killed as a result of the actions of the Baltimore police, but he had actually been killed before that in a way. He had been poisoned by lead in the home where he and his family grew up. It was a lead-infested apartment owned by an infamous slumlord in Baltimore who didn't go to jail for his actions, just like no slumlords in the city of Baltimore who had these lead-infested homes ever did. Freddie Gray ultimately had lead levels 2, 3, 4 times what's considered safe and considered actual evidence of lead poisoning. Although his family received the settlement for that, it was certainly not considered criminal. So when we talk about impoverishment, let's be clear, we're talking about a verb, not a noun. People are not in poverty. They are impoverished by processes that keep them in communities as virtual concentration camps. The so-called ghetto was certainly created in that fashion. Let's remember, public housing was created for poor white people initially, and then at the same time that government created public housing for poor white people, they then proceeded to create new opportunities for white folks to leave that very same public housing and urban areas, move to the suburbs where only we could live, using FHA loans, VA loans, later the GI Bill, and keeping people of color in the very same spaces where they could then really not leave. And so if we don't understand the way that our cities came to be decayed because of so-called progress, because of economic development, then we can't understand why they look the way they look now and end up being over-policed now and have real problems. But those problems are not created by the people who live there. They were historically created by the people who most certainly did not live there. And unless we understand that, then it becomes very difficult to figure out how we're going to move forward.
I read a book called Who Needs the Negro by Wilhelm. Part of the thesis in that was with the changing nature of the economy, the advent of robotization, etc., we don't have the same necessity for this reserve army of labor, of the working class, of people of color. Thus, in many ways, what do you do with people who are not useful to the economic structure and thus the growth of the prison industrial complex as a way of cultural and social control? That was the systemic analysis of who was poor, what do you do about the poor, and the incarceration rate.
That analysis that you had a large group of individuals, especially folks of color, who were becoming superfluous to the economy and could be sloughed off without much consideration, certainly was beginning to be true by the mid to late 70s as the decline in manufacturing began to kick in all around the country and the Rust Belt and elsewhere. The fact that lower income working class folks of color were being looked at as superfluous, as ultimately, you know, prison being the only housing policy that the United States government had for them after, let's say, the 80s, was something that was ignored by most. White folks, by and large, looked at it with bemusement, very little concern, actually would rationalize it, justify mass incarceration, with, you know, cutting back on programs intended to ease the misery to some extent, though usually not very much. Ultimately, what happens is that the power brokers of that same society come to recognize that if we can make black working class people superfluous and brown working class people superfluous and replace them, whether it's with machines or send their jobs overseas, then we can do the same thing with white working class people. If we can do predatory loans in black neighborhoods in the 1980s and early 90s, and then the government doesn't stop us, then as bankers, we can do the same thing in white working class neighborhoods. And so all of the crises that were becoming systemic in black and brown space, you know, 40 and 50 years ago, or that had been systemic in those spaces essentially forever, have now become systemic in many of those same white working class communities. Their jobs are being sent away, and they are experiencing long-term unemployment during the recession, and they are experiencing predatory lending. When you do not take care of business and create justice and equity on the front end for people of color, ultimately the folks who prey upon those people of color will come around and do the very same thing to white folks. And we saw that a couple weeks ago, the video going around the internet of, I think, the Carrier plant in Indiana. The guy comes in with the nice suit from the corporate office and says, just want to let you all know, we're sending your jobs to Monterrey, Mexico. Have a nice day. Mostly working class white guys explode in rage, as well they should. But where was the outrage from the same kind of people when those kinds of jobs that were providing really decent incomes for a working class and middle class black community in the auto industry and the steel industry in many places in this country were shutting down? Where was the concern when people of color who were being preyed upon? Until we are prepared to engage in real solidarity, then you're going to see those same working class white folks still not getting the point. And so they're going to say, well, those Mexicans took my job. No, the Mexicans didn't take your job. The rich white dude in the corporate office decided that he would send the jobs to Mexico so that he could make more money. Till we understand that, we're not going to go very far.
Since you mentioned Bernie Sanders, I felt that he conflates race into class. The specific deprivation that people of African descent and Latinos face are dealt with the generalities. He doesn't get Black Lives Matter. The specificity of addressing the disparities economically, socially within these communities, and with that, the continued reticence of the white liberal community and media to say that someone is racist. One of the things that's said about Trump is his verbiage is just opportunistic and tactical, but that doesn't necessarily connote racism. Your thoughts on this?
I've come to find it to be relatively tedious to engage in discussions about who's racist and who's not. And on the one hand, those of us on the left and the anti-racist movement are pretty clear that we've all been conditioned to be racist and to engage in a degree of racism in this society. So to say that Donald Trump is racist is somewhat like saying he breathes air. We all do, and so it becomes sort of a non sequitur. Now, that's not to say, however, that we shouldn't be calling him out for his use of racism. There's a difference, in my opinion, between saying Donald Trump is trafficking in racism, which has to do with his actions, has to do with his rhetoric, has to do with his policy proposals, his scapegoating of people of color for problems they didn't cause, and saying Donald Trump is a racist. The difference may seem minor, but it's a relatively big one. To say he's racist in a culture where we've all been conditioned to be racist and where the evidence says we all have a certain degree of subconscious racism is just not a very meaningful proposition. To say that he engages in racism, that he pushes buttons of racial resentment and furthers systemic racism and a racist narrative by virtue of that rhetoric is a very meaningful distinction. Even if we all have a degree of racism and subconscious bias, we don't all traffic deliberately the manipulation of racial resentment. And so to me, I'd rather be focused on his actions, on his narrative, on his rhetoric, and what that rhetoric portends, than to say that he is a racist. It may be that he is, and it may, whatever. It's not about really caring what's in his heart per se. It's about saying that ultimately I know strategically and tactically to call someone a racist typically shuts down conversation. To say that they are engaging in racism or the politics of racial resentment opens up a conversation. It's not about whether the Tea Party and all of its members or even most of its members are racist individuals. It's about whether they are trafficking in the politics of racism and whether their analysis is furthering racism. And as I said at the time, and I'll say now, the background noise of everything that the Tea Party was doing was racial resentment. And I would say that the background noise of virtually everything coming out of the mouth of Donald Trump is the politics of racial resentment and furthers a politic of white supremacy. And
you prefer the term now of white nationalism rather than white supremacy or racism relevant to what is being stoked by Donald Trump.
I'm still willing to use the term white supremacy because I think it fits in most of these cases, but we do need to understand that the folks who are being empowered certainly call themselves white nationalists. They are white separatists. They believe in the United States as a white nation and would like to see non-whites either removed from it or that the country be carved up into different ethnic states, people like Richard Spencer, people like Matt Heimbach, the folks who have been on the internet talking about Donald Trump as their quote-unquote glorious leader, the folks at Daily Stormer, the folks at various right-wing and white nationalist, white supremacist, neo-Nazi websites. We need to understand it as white nationalism because where it allows us to understand the bright line connection between more mainstream reactionary politics and the politics of the truly fascist far right, actually wanting to create a white nation, either by purging those who are not white from it or creating these separate ethnic states, is the project. It is more important to them than the claiming of supremacy. Do I believe they're white supremacists? Yes, I believe that they believe white people are, because they say so, superior to others. Sometimes they'll try to fudge that and say, well, no, we actually think Asians are superior because they have higher IQ, blah, blah, blah. But notice they don't want a lot of Asians in the country. So you'd think that if they really believed Asians were superior, they'd want a lot of them around. But in fact, they're very clear they don't, because they think that Asians need to be in Asia and white people need to be in whatever whitetopia the United States they believe is. And so we need to understand the long-term project here. It isn't just about proclaiming the superiority of one particular group. It is about literally purging those who don't fit that definition from the country as a whole. And whether or not that is the explicit goal of someone like Donald Trump or whether that's something he uses for political effect, it is those people who are empowered by his rhetoric, who have been enthusiastically supporting his campaign because they know that whether he wins or loses and whether or not he could actually do any of the things he says he would do, whether he could ever build a wall with Mexico, whether or not he could ever do mass deportation, whether he could ever block Muslims from entering the country, none of which he could practically get away with without literally some level of fascistic overthrow of the system itself. They don't care. They dislike the fact that he has made those issues, which have been their issues for a very long time, mainstream. So he is empowering some of the most reactionary forces at this or any other time.
Your new book, Under the Affluence, give us some of the conceptual framework, the system of inequality that sets up people of color to have really lower success rates and consequently fill the positions in society that have been designed for them, which is one of the things that's dealt with in your book.
The policies and practices that resulted in the immiseration of black and brown communities were very much created by design. That certainly is the way that the economy was founded in this country, that people of color would do the labor that would make at least one certain group of white people wealthier, and that even the lowest rung working class white person would always be above the highest rung black or brown person. Now, there obviously are individuals within black and brown communities who are quite a bit above the status, at least economically, of certain white folks in this country. But by and large, the caste system was set up that way beginning in the colonial period, and it was maintained through propaganda, through the use for what Du Bois called the psychological wage of whiteness, telling working class white folks that they had more in common with rich white folks than they did black and brown folks who shared their same economic strata. It worked all throughout American history. During the period of the Civil War, where people from my part of the country, from the American South, essentially landless peasants who were white, were told and came to believe that slavery was something to be maintained, even though they themselves didn't own other human beings, even though the slave system really bid down the wages of all working people. example, by allowing rich white people to have black folks doing work for free rather than having to pay them, which doesn't exactly help you if you're a white worker who wants to work on the farm for $2 a day or $2 a week or whatever the wage would have been at the time. So it worked. It tricked working class white people into believing that the system of enslavement was in the long run good for them. So they went and fought and died, and 600,000 people died in a war to maintain white supremacy. You have the same thing happening in the labor union movement, white working people in unions being told by the union bosses, specifically in the AFL in the early days, that if you let black people or Mexicans or Chinese into your union, it's going to bid down the quality of the work, lower the quality of the craft. Well, no, it would double your union, and that would probably be helpful when you go out on strike. But of course, working class white folks were, again, suckered by the elites at that time. It's working today in the immigration debate, where folks are being told, if you just keep these people out of the country, your wages will go up, everything will be fine, as if somehow the capitalist class is going to suddenly start paying living wages just because brown folks can't come over a border. That's just not going to happen. They continue to send the jobs away. So all of that has been really quite deliberate. And when I say deliberate, I don't mean in the conspiratorial sense. I'm not suggesting that there is some vast and grand conspiracy of people behind the shadows. What I am saying is that the system was certainly set up as that kind of a system, and now it's on autopilot. It has its own internal logic, its own rationalizations. These are rationalizations that we all engage to some extent. The point that I try to make in the book is that one of the reasons it's so hard to break the class system in the United States is that, unlike class systems in Europe, the difference between those systems historically and ours is that those systems were part of a larger feudal arrangement that people could see as unjust without too much effort. It was obvious. If you're not a member of the royalty, you ain't going to be a member of the royalty. If you're a peasant, you're going to be a peasant. You're going to live and die a peasant unless there's a revolution. In the United States, the pernicious aspect of our class system is not just the way that race is propped up. It's that myth of meritocracy. It's that notion that, no, in this country, if you just work hard, you can make it. And wherever you end up is all about you. Nobody said that in England. Nobody said that in Germany. Nobody said that in France, because everybody knew it was nonsense. But in the United States, we have just enough mobility historically, just enough that it becomes possible to believe that. And that is an incredible ideological tool to maintain a system of inequality, because it means if I'm struggling right now, rather than trying to get together with other struggling people and change that system, I just say, well, I've just got to double down, and rather than working 40 hours a week, maybe I'll work 50 hours a week. And rather than 50, maybe I'll work 60, and maybe I just won't take vacations, and maybe I'll work on the weekend. Maybe I won't see my kids for days at a time because I'm working and working and working. And then what happens is that the system doesn't change, and the people who double down on hard work rather than changing systemic realities end up working themselves into an early grave. And we're seeing that in terms of mortality rates ticking up in working class white communities recently, 45 to 54 year old white folks without a college degree, seeing a massive jump in mortality rates from suicide, from opioid addiction, from cirrhosis brought on by heavy drinking, all of which suggests that the class system that was set up to, at least in relative terms, elevate white people over people of color, and which has done that, is now starting to consume its own. It is becoming a cancer on the larger economic body, including the body that white folks rely on for decent jobs and livable wages.
We want to thank Tim Wise for spending the time that he has with us. And you've got to just get Under the Affluence by Tim Wise to deepen our theoretical knowledge, to inform our social political practice, to deal with these issues, to build a society that indeed is both diverse and has equity and fairness within it. Tim Wise, it's always a pleasure hearing from you.
Thanks so much, Mimi. I appreciate it.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.